Metcast, Monday, March 20th, 2017. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your Maccast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back. I hope you're having a wonderful week. Every time I get ready to do the show, I think, you know what, this is going to be a week where we just have nothing to talk about. And sure enough, there is plenty when I go back and review my show notes. I kind of do them throughout the week, so I'm picking up stories here and there and adding to them little by little, and then come at the start of every episode, wow, we've got some things to get into. Probably on top of the list is, by the time you hear this, there may be some new products hitting the Apple Store. We're going to talk about that a little bit. We're going to talk about why the new iPhone might be more expensive than you think, or at least as expensive as we've been talking about, but why is it going to be expensive? A little bit of that. Apple's hired a new employee. That's pretty interesting. We'll be discussing who that is and why he was added to Apple's staff. Some updates on possibly new Apple TV, some international news, a little bit on Apple Care, and a little more on Apple's ambitions for augmented reality. We've got all of that and some feedback from you. A lot of feedback on the issue we talked about last time where monitors seem to have issues when connected to the Mac. I got great feedback on that, and another tip or trick for those of you who might be having issues to try out. How secure is your Mac OS account? We're going to get into security a little bit, basically security of your data on your Mac, and we're going to talk about some things related to that. I got a comment from Steve about CarPlay and an app that can help you do a little bit more with your live photos. So it should be a great episode. Stay tuned. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. So you may already know how great Text Expander is for your personal use. Maybe you have your own workflows and your snippets that you can't live without. I certainly do. I have Text Expander on every one of my Macs, but I work for myself. I'm self-employed. I'm sitting here by myself. What happens if you're in a team? You're in an office environment. You have a club that you work with, a work group, a study group, something like that. What if you want to get everyone on Text Expander and sharing their snippets and making everyone's workflows better? Well, you can do that with Text Expander for Teams. It's all about sharing the experience of snippets and gaining the efficiency and helping each other with that and gaining more productivity. Text Expander for Teams can beef up not just your productivity, but the productivity of everyone that you work with. With Text Expander for Teams, everyone can share and use the best snippets from other members of the team. So a great example of this is, say you have Steve in customer service. He's great at answering emails because he's built up a library of Text Expander snippets. He's built in things like logic. He's got replies for different scenarios, and he can just, in a couple quick snippets, put together an email very quickly, very efficiently. Well, why not let everyone on that team, on that customer service team, be as good at those replies as Steve? And they can, because with Text Expander for Teams, they can share his snippets. And best of all, snippets are easy to find because they go into your snippet collection, your library, and they are immediately accessible and searchable through the abbreviation and the keyboard shortcuts, so you can find and share the very best snippets among your team. And your team can use Text Expander for Teams from any computer or device because it's available on Mac, iOS, and yes, even Windows. So don't worry if you have a mixed environment. Everybody can take advantage of Text Expander for Teams. So to get Text Expander for Teams, to see how it can work for you in your work group, in your office, just visit textexpander.com/Maccast to start your free trial and learn how companies such as WordPress and Desk multiply their productivity using Text Expander. Text Expander for Teams from Smile, and a big thank you to Smile for their support of the MacCast. By the time you are hearing this very episode, it may be possible that there is a new Apple product, or maybe a few Apple products available in the Apple Store for you to buy. Mac Rumors claims to have reputable supply chain analysts that told them last week that Apple would launch new products this week. And that seems odd because we haven't had any kind of special event or an announcement, but also over the weekend, the Apple system status page was updated to note that the store, Apple Store, Apple's online store, would be down for maintenance between 3 a.m. and 8:30 a.m. on Tuesday, March 21st. Often when Apple is taking the system offline, it is for doing product updates. The note on the status page just says down for maintenance, so take that with a grain of salt. But we have been hearing that Apple has been getting ready to update the iPad Pro line. We've been talking about that a little bit on the show. Now, in the Mac Rumors report, the products that were supposedly going to be announced were not specified, but many are speculating it could be these new iPads. I think that would be odd because normally Apple would have some sort of an event. In the past, it's been held at the end of March to announce new iPads, but no invites have been sent out, and a quiet launch to me, while it could happen, doesn't seem very likely for something as significant as the iPad Pro, especially considering the number of theories we've been hearing about what these models or what these updates would be. I think Apple could quietly launch a iPad lineup with a new low-cost 7.9-inch model and maybe a modest update to the 12.9-inch, but we've also been hearing this rumor that there's going to be an all-new design of a 10.5-inch iPad Pro. And if that is the case, I think Apple's really going to want to show that off. They're going to want to hold some sort of special event, and I think it's going to happen later in the month. Now, there has been a few other rumors that could indicate this product we might see this week, and one would be an updated iPhone SE. There have been these rumors that Apple's going to update the iPhone SE line, put in some new processors, and maybe add a 128-gigabyte model to the lineup. So that could happen quietly. I could see that coming out, and that may be what's being updated. The other rumor we've been hearing that seems logical is that Apple may do a product red edition of the iPhone 7. So they may quietly add a new color of the iPhone 7 to the iPhone 7, 7 Plus lineup. And that would make sense for kind of a just quiet update to the store. So I'd put my money on the SE and not quite on an iPad Pro update. They do seem, however, to be getting close to announcing some new iPads, and the question now becomes, where are they going to do that? And there's been a lot of speculation surrounding where this event might happen. Now, last year, it was at the Apple campus in Cupertino, but as you may or may not know, Tim Cook already came out and said the last time they had an event at the theater in Cupertino, he said, this is going to be our last event here. We're finishing up here, and the next time we do a new event, it is going to be in the new facility, now, as we know, named Apple Park. There's also the Steve Jobs Theater at Apple Park, and that seems like the logical next location for a special event, but it's not quite ready yet. We don't know when it will be done. We do know that Apple and the employees are going to be moving into Apple Park sometime in April, but they had already noted that the Steve Jobs Theater would be done later in the year. Beginning of April, since that's right when they're moving in, doesn't seem likely to be later in the year. I guess they could kind of rush things and maybe get things done, maybe bring in people without the landscaping in place. I don't think this seems very likely. Now, the Bill Graham Theater seems like a place they could have it, at least if the event is going to happen early in April. But but we don't even know if that's the date. Maybe it's going to happen even later. It's just speculation at this point that the announcement might come in April. I do think it's going to come in April, and I think it's going to be someplace off-site, not at Apple's new Apple Park Steve Jobs Theater. Just my theory, but that's what I think. The only thing that seems really certain at this point is that Apple is getting close to having some iPads ready to go. Ship dates on the iPad Pro 12.9-inch have been slipping a bit. That's usually an indication that Apple's getting ready to put some new product into the market. There's also a mobile data marketing firm this past week called FixQ that told TechCrunch that they had seen some iPad models listed as 7.1, 7.2, 7.3, and 7.4 show up in logs for devices near and around Cupertino and around San Francisco. Now, this is coming from different applications reporting data. So it seems like somebody is testing some kind of new device. The four numbers there likely indicate actually two different models, maybe a Wi-Fi version and a cellular version of two different kinds of iPads, probably the 12.9-inch updated Pro and the 9.7-inch, and likely not this new 10.5-inch, but again, we're just speculating. The report claims that the devices were running a mix of iOS 10.3 beta, which is the latest version of iOS beta. I think they actually may have updated and come out with a beta 4 just in the past couple days, but a fairly recent version of iOS 10.3 beta. But then the report also notes some of the devices running iOS 11. And to me, that seems a little bit odd. That seems like it'd be a bit early. We would expect Apple to make an announcement about iOS 11 at WWDC in June. So that throws this rumor a little bit off for me. But they did note that the device usage was noticed across a range of different kinds of applications. FixQ takes a look at app analytics, and different games or apps have their software in there, and that's how they're getting these numbers and seeing these indicated. So the assumption is that some of these test iPads would have different apps on there that are using the FixQ system. And they said they've seen everything from games to music apps to real estate apps to weather apps. So it's a wide range of testing that may be going on. And that's the assumption, is that Apple's testing these things, and if they're testing them, they're getting close to getting ready to release something. Now, DigiTimes seems to think also that the supply chain points to an announcement of the iPad 10.5-inch at an event again in early April. So more indication that early April may be the special event date timeframe that we're looking for. They say Apple wants to mark the inauguration of Apple's new campus, Apple Park, with an event. Now, I don't take this to mean that they're going to have and hold the event on the Apple Park campus. What I'm thinking is that they want to be moved into, or in the process of moving into, Apple Park, and likely Tim Cook would open the special event talking about Apple Park and some of the unique features of it and the fact that Apple is now moving their employees into that facility. So I think that's kind of the event to mark the inauguration. They'll kind of announce it to the world that they've moved into the new campus. Now, DigiTimes also says that Apple will target the new Pro iPads at the education and business sector. So they're going to kind of go after that market for the new iPad Pro marketing. And interestingly, they say that the 10.5-inch iPad Pro will be out in April, but that the 12.9-inch models will be released later. They say that the date remains unclear, but kind of indicate that ship dates could slip to May or June, which that's, again, a little bit odd in this rumor, because that's not the new iPad. They wouldn't be changing much other than updating the internals and the processor. So either the idea is that Apple is totally focused on this new 10.5-inch iPad Pro, trying to get that out the door and get the new processors and technology in there, and sort of holding back on the 12.9-inch iPad Pro update, leaving that for a little bit later. that can make sense, especially if they're supply constrained for some of the component parts that they need to do these updates. But again, a little bit odd. You would think they'd be able to ship both those models around the same time frame. So again, DigiTimes is hit or miss on their rumors. I'm going to take this one with a little hesitation. But all in all, I think everything is pointing to some iPad updates sometime in early April. We've been talking a lot lately, too, about the iPhone 8, or what we now think is going to be the iPhone edition, the special redesigned 10th anniversary edition of the iPhone. And one of the things we've been talking a lot about is the rumored price point. Many of the rumors are pointing to the fact that that device is probably going to be priced above $1,000 US. And DigiTimes is claiming that they may know why, specifically saying, look, the parts that are going into this thing, they're going to be pricey, and Apple's going to pass that along. I think it's not surprising, considering the fact that we've been hearing the new iPhone is going to have all kinds of new tech inside of it. DigiTimes points out a key component, the OLED screen in the iPhone. It's going to be using a thin film touch sensor overlaid onto an AMOLED display, they say, one that's going to be supplied by TPK Holdings. DigiTimes likes to look a lot at the supply chain to kind of figure out their rumors. And they note that this new panel requires a new type of 3D touch sensor, and say that those will be about $15. That's the cost to Apple versus the $9 cost of the current 3D touch sensor in the iPhone 7, iPhone 7 Plus. So they're adding about $6 to the component cost just for that one component in the new phone design. And it doesn't sound like much of a difference considering the overall cost of the iPhone. But as they point out, that one part is now 60% more expensive to Apple. And we've heard reports of other new components, things like the front-facing camera with 3D and depth sensing technology that's going to be based on lasers. It'll allow it to do things like facial recognition, iris scanning, 3D spatial analysis, and things like that. And a lot of people think this is going to be used in Apple's new augmented reality applications. Well, that's got to be expensive, right? That has to be a lot more costly than the current camera sensor that they're using for the front-facing camera, which is the one we've had for a long time. So that's going to drive component costs off. And then we've And then we've been hearing about other technologies, like Apple adding in wireless charging components. Those have never been in there before, so there's another component cost. Some sort of new fingerprint sensor, since there's not going to be a physical home button. And then we've been hearing about this new integrated function bar, which may have OLED technology in it also. So a lot of new bits and pieces in here that are going to drive up the initial component cost. All this tech in the bill of materials is ultimately likely going to mean a higher price to Apple, which means if they want to maintain their margins on iPhone, they're going to pass that cost along to us. We're going to have to pay a premium for all that premium tech in the new iPhone. And here's the reality, I think. Apple knows customers will pay more to be the first with the quote-unquote new iPhone, the one that looks different, the one that they can take out and show their friends, and their friends can say, hey, is that the new iPhone? And you say, yes, I've got the new one. There's a status that goes along with that, and people are willing to pay for that. And not only that, you can be sure, even at the higher price, they're probably not going to be able to produce enough to keep up with demand. So that's another indication that they could charge a little bit more, right? There's going to be a very high demand for this phone. And classic, you know, if your economics 101, supply and demand dictates the price. So yes, people are going to complain about it. I guarantee a lot of people are going to run the negative review saying that it's overpriced. But at the end of the day, Apple's bottom line is going to show that people are going to be willing to pay for it. And yeah, I agree. It does seem like it's getting a little bit ridiculous. $1,000, $1,100, $1,200 for a smartphone is getting a little bit crazy. But The reality is that's probably where it's going to land. And it does make sense that part of the thing that's driving that cost up is all this new tech and these new parts. Speaking of some of that new tech, a report from the Nikkei Asian Review claims that the curved screen we've been hearing about won't be all that curved. They also say that it will be curved purely for aesthetics and not function. I don't think that's anything really new. I think some people maybe thought that it might be like the Samsung Galaxy Edge, where in the curved area, there's extra screen and extra kind of functionality. I never thought Apple was really going to do that. But we've also heard similar rumors last week from other sources that the display would be more like the 2.5D display that is on the iPhone 7 and iPhone 7 Plus. So if you think about your iPhone 7, 7 Plus screen, you really don't think of it as a quote-unquote curved display, but right at the edge, it is just kind of rolled a little bit. It's got a nice little curvature to it, and that's what is referred to as the 2.5D display design. Now, to counter that and maybe even explain this discrepancy where we've been hearing, Apple is working on this new curved display or curved screen or curved glass, rather, for the iPhone edition. There is a report from the Korean site ET News, and they say that the new iPhone is going to have what they're calling a, quote, water drop design, basically mimicking the curved body and the rounded corners, the more pronounced rounded corners of the original iPhone. So if you think back all the way back to the very original iPhone, it kind of had this, I'm going to call it almost like pillow-like design, right? It was pretty curved on the edges and pretty curved corners. They're saying Apple's going to mimic that design, but in an all-glass design, meaning that the back glass is going to be 3D curved glass and wrap around, come up to meet the flatter 2.5D front glass, which will be the screen. So it won't be quite as rounded all the way around as the old iPhone, original iPhone design, but it's going to sort of take its cues from that. At least that's what the ET News is sort of alluding to. And that's an interesting thought. The one thing that I think makes this viable is, again, we've had these conflicting rumors of 3D glass and 2.5D glass. So maybe it ends up being both. We are just going to have to wait and see. But at least one analyst, Morgan Stanley's Katie Huberty, thinks Wall Street, which is already pretty bullish on the iPhone 8, by the way, she's thinking they may be underestimating its impact. She thinks that iPhone unit sales will rise by 20% in fiscal 2018. Now, fiscal 2018, just for those of us who, you know, are a little confused by the calendar, at least in terms of Apple's financials, Apple starts its fiscal 2018 quarter on October 1st, 2017. So those are the numbers they report as Q1 2018. Those will be reported usually in like January of 2018, and they cover that last quarter of the year. So she's talking about the last quarter, the holiday quarter, the quarter that Apple usually does really well. She thinks iPhone unit sales are going to go up by 20% in that quarter, and that's about twice as much as her peers on Wall Street are predicting. And she even notes that it could go even higher, as high as 30%. That would be record-breaking iPhone sales, you know, higher than ever, a bigger percentage gain than Apple typically sees. So that would be a really big deal. But you have to remember to go, though, especially with a new device, and this is where I think she's being a little over-optimistic, Apple seems to wrestle with supply chain issues. So I think Apple could pull off numbers like that if they could keep up with demand, but historically they've not been able to do that. They've always been kind of chasing that, especially in the first few months, first quarter after the launch of a brand new design, a brand new device like that. So if demand is really going to be as high as many are thinking it's going to be, and Apple has a hard time getting stuff out the door, then I think the 10% figure that her peers are throwing out there is probably a little more realistic. But regardless, I think this thing, I do agree, I think the iPhone 8, the iPhone Edition, whatever you want to call it, is going to be huge. And finally, don't count the iPhone 7 out yet. It is still doing very well, at least according to the latest data from Kantar. They showed that the iPhone 7 was the top-selling smartphone in most of the largest markets in the world. As a matter of fact, in the U.S. market, iPhone's share of the smartphone market was 42%, according to the research firm. That compared to all other Android makers combined, which had 56.4%. So I thought that was pretty impressive. Apple, with the iPhone, they're one device. I mean, two different sizes, but one device is right up there with all of the Android makers selling phones in the U.S., at least very close, within, you know, a few percentage points. Well, let's just say 14, right? But still pretty good. And then in Europe, iPhone held strong at 22.7% share, and the iPhone 7 was the best-selling phone in France, Germany, and the UK among smartphones. Now, it was not all rosy, though, according to the Kantar numbers. The iPhone did lose share in Japan and in Spain, and it saw its share in China fall 16.6%, but it did still remain the top-selling smartphone in China. So falling pretty largely, and that would be a concern, I think, for Apple. China is a pretty big market and something they're probably going to have to work on turning around. We do know they're making some efforts to do that. Hopefully they can get that turned around, and maybe the upcoming iPhone 8 will help out with that. But that's the latest on iPhone. One reason I am happy that I am a Mac and an iPhone iOS user is that Apple works pretty hard to make sure that they protect our security and privacy. They give us a lot of tools to be able to do that. They give us a lot of settings and options to be able to control how much information and data we want to share through our Macs and our devices. And I think they're doing a pretty good job of doing that. And I was excited this week to see that they've hired someone, I think, that's going to be able to take their security and privacy efforts even further. Jonathan Zidziarski has accepted a position with Apple's security engineering and architecture team. He put up a post on his blog and he noted that his move is, quote, "the conclusion of what I feel has been a matter of conscience for me over time. Privacy is sacred." So he too seems to be a guy who's very concerned about protecting our privacy on devices. And as a matter of fact, he mentions that he's excited about joining a group of, quote, like-minded individuals who share his passion for protecting the security and privacy of others. Now, with his research efforts over the years, Zidziarski uncovered and reported on many security and privacy flaws, giving them to Apple's team and helping them make iOS even stronger and more secure and able to protect our privacy better. So he's already in a lot of ways contributed to what we have benefited from in terms of Apple's hardware and software. So having him on the team is only going to be better. He also, according to iMore, recently made the app Little Flocker, which is a monitoring tool that will watch apps running on your Mac and not allow them to access files and data without your explicit permission. So it kind of does a little reporting, kind of squawking on different apps and what they might be trying to access and share on your system. Kind of works like Little Snitch, but for documents. Pretty neat little app, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But it just sort of shows the efforts that Jonathan Zidziarski has been going through to kind of help, again, protect security and privacy. He thinks a lot about it, and it's pretty important to him. So having him on this team at Apple is going to be great for us as Mac and iOS users. As far as what the security engineering team is all about, they are responsible for hardening iOS. They also created Gatekeeper and added system integrity protection to the Mac operating system. And they recently created a new bug bounty program last year that will hopefully help get even more bugs, security holes, and things like that reported to Apple. So at the end of the day, between what the team is already doing, what Jonathan has been already working on, and bringing that together, to me, it seems like a really great fit. And I think having him on Apple's team is going to be good for both us and Apple. So I certainly welcome him to Apple and look forward to some great things. Good news if you're one of the folks waiting for the fifth generation Apple TV. Bloomberg had already said that Apple was apparently testing some kind of new Apple TV, likely a 4K version of the device. Now, Fiery Games says that they are seeing evidence that Apple may be testing a new Apple TV unit. They say they saw an unusual device identified as an Apple TV 6.2 and running TVOS 11.0 connect to Phoenix HD for Apple TV. That's one of their applications. So basically alluding that Apple has a new Apple TV, a new version of an Apple TV running the Phoenix HD application on it, and that they're doing some testing. They noted that the IP logs also seem to be in a range that's linked to Apple's Cupertino headquarters. So again, further evidence that maybe Apple is internally testing something. Now, it's important to remember that these device identifiers and IPs and all those things can be pretty easily faked. So it could just be someone messing around, but couple this with some of the other evidence and other rumors we've been hearing, and it does make sense that Apple, again, is getting into that phase of doing testing that they're going to do right before announcing or releasing a new product. And as far as what it is going to be, we've just been hearing that Apple will take pretty much the existing design, existing technology, and put it out in a 4K edition, something that people have wanted since the Apple TV fourth generation was released. Many couldn't believe that it didn't have 4K support in that unit. I really think it was mostly due to the lack of 4K content availability. Now, the question would be, if Apple does release a new 4K TV, are they going to start selling 4K content on iTunes? I think they would almost have to release both in conjunction. What else could we expect from a new Apple TV? It's really unknown at this point. So far, the 4K is all that we have heard about, but I think along with 4K, it would probably come with a modest CPU and GPU bump. And the GPU especially could help out with the 4K video content. So those things would go hand in hand, I would imagine. And also, you know, games could potentially benefit from some beefier CPU and GPU as well. So when that will happen, we're not really hearing anything at this point in terms of hard dates. It could be announced alongside maybe those iPads, or maybe a little bit later, maybe more toward the WWDC timeframe. We're just going to have to wait and see. We have a couple of international news stories to cover this week, starting off with Apple announcing last Friday that they would be opening two new R&D centers in China, and that they plan to spend at least $507 million US to bring four different centers, R&D centers, online. Apple already had been working on two centers in Beijing and Shenzhen. Now they will be adding facilities in Shanghai and Suzhou. All of the facilities are expected to open in 2017. And as we noted earlier, with declining sales in China, Apple is looking to get more favorable trade deals, and opening these new facilities can only help. Apple is looking to staff the facilities with talent from the supply chain and graduates from some of the country's best local universities. Apple put a focus also on internship programs that they plan for the new facilities, which they hope will, quote, develop the next generation of entrepreneurs in China. Apple will resume sales in Indonesia after being forced to stop sales just a few years ago due to new local regulations. Indonesia had enacted a 30% rule, meaning that Apple has to use a minimum of 30% local components in smartphones distributed throughout the country. Apparently, they've been able to meet the requirement by promising a local research and development center in Jakarta as a commitment, with promises of a $44 million investment over 3 years. I'm not really sure how that meets the 30% rule requirement, but apparently that was enough for Indonesia. Apple will begin selling iPhone 7, iPhone 7 Plus, iPhone 6S, and 6S Plus through six retailers across major cities in Indonesia starting on March 31st. Indonesia is the fourth most populated country in the world with over 260 million people, so getting back into that market was an important move for Apple. Apple has not paid taxes in New Zealand in 10 years. That's despite generating revenue of about $4.2 billion in New Zealand since 2007. Now, here's the thing. Even though Apple has not been paying taxes to New Zealand's Inland Revenue, which is their tax department on those sales, it's perfectly legal. There was a treaty between Australia and New Zealand over dual income tax claims, and it defaults the payments to the country where the company is controlled from. Now, Apple New Zealand is actually owned by a parent company in Australia, and so therefore the taxes from both countries are paid to the Australian tax office. As a matter of fact, they're paid at a slightly higher rate, I think 30% in Australia, whereas if Apple had gone with New Zealand, it would have been 28%. But either way, New Zealand is missing out on the tax revenue from those sales in their country, which has some critics in New Zealand not happy about the situation, saying that, quote, it's just that age-old distinction between legality and morality. And they're basically calling on Apple to quote, do the right thing in New Zealand and pay their taxes there. Now, I get that many want corporations to kind of take this righteous high road, but I have to look at it and say, you know, I'm not so certain that it's really realistic. You know, Apple is a business. They are following the rules that were set forth. It was Australia and New Zealand that put these rules together, and Apple taking advantage of that is just a business thing. Now, we can get into this moral gray area, but in a lot of ways, I kind of feel like it'd be like asking any one of us to not take a tax deduction or a credit just because, you know what, the state really needs that money. So, you know, don't take that deduction. Don't play by the rules. You know, do what you think is right and just give them the money. I don't think that's ever going to happen. So really, I think if New Zealand wants to change this, they're going to have to go back and look at that relationship, at that ruling, that treaty, and maybe make some changes to that. And I think once they do that, Apple would be perfectly happy to come back and follow the new rules as they apply to Apple. But until that happens, I really don't think I see this changing. And we've been seeing this in countries all over the world. This is a very similar situation to what happened in Ireland. We've seen it in a few other countries. And so I get and understand completely why this would be frustrating to the country that's missing out on this revenue. It's a big deal. It's a lot of money. But at the same time, Apple has not been doing anything wrong. And so to call them out or say they're morally corrupt or morally bankrupt or whatever thing you want to fling at them, I think that's just really not fair. I think they're running a business. They're playing by the rules. And as a publicly held company, they actually have a responsibility to do exactly that. So until the rules change, I have a feeling that's exactly what they're going to keep doing. If you did not buy AppleCare Plus with your new iPhone 7, iPhone 7 Plus, you may have figured that your time was up, that it was too late to add that to your current model. Well, Mac Rumors is saying that you may not be too late. They say that Apple is adjusting the rules for AppleCare Plus on iPhone to be more in line with their other products like Macs and Apple TV. They say you will now be allowed to purchase or will soon be allowed to purchase AppleCare Plus for your iPhone up to 1 year from the date of original purchase. The current rules state that AppleCare Plus for iPhones must be purchased within the first 60 days, so that extension would be pretty significant if it does go forward. At this point, however, Apple has not announced or confirmed the rumor, so it remains just that, simply a rumor. I personally hope it is true because I think I actually forgot to get AppleCare Plus on my iPhone 7. I didn't order it online, and I was going to do it in store. I don't think I did it, so I hope this one turns out to be true. Over the past few months, we've been talking a lot about Apple's interest in augmented reality, and even more so, Tim Cook's interest in augmented reality technologies, and it's looking like we may be getting a little more clarity on when Apple will actually be showing us some stuff and maybe bringing some products to market. Citing knowledge of the company's plans, Bloomberg's Mark Gurman says that Tim Cook is about to get very serious about augmented reality, and getting serious means actually putting out some of the technology in their products. As evidence, he points out that Apple has hired an army of experts from companies like Dolby Laboratories, along with engineers who have worked on augmented reality technology like the Oculus and the HoloLens. I guess, though, Oculus is a little more VR-based, but you get the point. According to the piece, Apple has recruited Mike Rockwell from Dolby to run the main augmented reality team at Apple. Rockwell had also advised on a product called Meta, which was a set of augmented reality glasses from a small firm that come in at a cost of about $950. So not cheap, but pretty cool tech. The piece also says that, quote, hundreds of engineers are now engaged on Apple's augmented reality projects. You combine that with all of the acquisitions of companies that Apple has been making in the fields of augmented reality hardware, 3D gaming, virtual reality software, all stuff, again, that we've talked about on prior episodes of the MacCast, and you have a pretty amazing kind of dream team that could put together some really cool augmented reality stuff. Now, the belief at this point is that Apple will begin adding augmented reality features to the iPhone and eventually will develop a set of augmented reality glasses as an accessory for the iPhone. That last little bit of information may sting a little bit for our friend Robert Scoble, who was pretty convinced that Apple was getting ready to release a set of augmented reality glasses this year. It's looking like that is not going to happen. As far as the iPhone efforts go, the piece says that Apple has set some of the iPhone camera team working on augmented reality features for the iPhone, adding things like depth sensing functionality to allow new features and control of images and objects in 3D environments. The team Apple is putting together seems to be mimicking the effort and strategy Apple used to bring the Apple Watch to market. If you remember when Apple did that, they started acquiring and hiring a bunch of different talent and people, different companies, putting that together. They seem to be taking a similar tactic here with augmented reality. Apple will need to tackle the issue of how to make a product that has the power and battery life to kind of to accomplish these tasks. And chances are that Apple will need to develop maybe new chipsets and new techniques along with operating systems and software to be able to pull all of this off. So that's why you need this kind of talent. Luckily, these are the kinds of skills I think that Apple absolutely has. It's definitely what they excel at. And you can guarantee that when and if they do put a product out into market, it is going to be pretty fully fleshed out and it is going to make sense. Applications are how Apple makes this stuff work. They give us something that we can use in our day-to-day lives and something that's going to impact and change how we use technology. It's very key. Apple does not tend to give us just gimmicks and little tricks. Occasionally, we get some of those extras, those little, I kind of think of them almost like flourishes, but the core technology is usually pretty significant and has some sort of impact. So I think that's what they're trying to set out to do here. As far as the Mark Gurman piece goes, it concludes that AR-enhanced glasses are still, quote, further down the road, and that it's key for Apple to get the product right. And I completely agree with that. So that's kind of what's happening with AR. And with that, that is going to finish up the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is GoDaddy. GoDaddy's mission is to radically shift the global economy toward life-fulfilling independent ventures. They help their customers succeed by giving them the tools, insights, and people to transform their ideas and personal initiative into success. With more than 14 million customers worldwide and 62 million domain names under management, GoDaddy gives small business owners the tools to name their idea, build a beautiful online presence, attract customers, and manage their business. GoDaddy is the world's largest technology provider dedicated to small business and the largest domain registrar. They offer award-winning 24/7 customer support to help you build your online business and provide everything you need to get your business online. Whether you have a new idea or an established business, the key to success online starts with a great domain name. They offer big savings over other registrars and are trusted by 13 million customers, more than any other registrar. Right now, GoDaddy is offering MacCast listeners 30% off all new products. Just go to GoDaddy.com and enter the coupon code MacCast30 at checkout to save 30% off all new products. And a big thanks to GoDaddy for their support of the MacCast. Last time on the MacCast, we had someone on who was talking about the new LG monitors, and they were having issues with their Mac not waking from sleep, or more accurately, the monitor not waking back up when they were waking the Mac from sleep. And I mentioned that I've had similar kinds of monitor issues, or issues with my third-party HP displays. On my own Mac, I have issues where it will not sleep properly. So when my Mac goes to sleep, the monitor starts to go to sleep and then sort of wakes back up and then starts to go to sleep again and gets in this cycle. So I actually have to reach over and turn the power off physically. Now, on my wife's Mac Mini, rather, she has this issue with her HP monitor where occasionally she'll try and wake it from sleep and the monitor will just freak out or it won't come on at all. And I was asking if other people had sort of had these kinds of issues, and boy, did I get a lot of feedback from you. There seems to be a whole range of kind of weird monitor issues that happen with Macs, and it doesn't seem to happen only with third-party displays. I even had one of you email me and say that you have the issue with an Apple DisplayPort monitor, one of Apple's own monitors. So this isn't just an Apple issue, maybe, or just a third-party monitor issue. It's also just an issue with monitors in general. I don't know if it's software-related, hardware-related. Who really knows what's going on? The one thing that I did hear about a lot, though, was the ultimate fix seems to be turning it off and back on again. I know it's cliche, but many of you wrote in to say, you know, I have this problem with my monitor. It won't wake from sleep, or something else happens. It gets disconnected weirdly. Turning the power off and back on doesn't work. Disconnecting the DisplayPort cable, Thunderbolt cable, that doesn't work. What really works for me is actually just reaching over, yanking the power cord from the wall, and then plugging the power cord back in. There were at least 3 or 4 people that said, yeah, I have monitor issues and this is how I fix it. So I wanted to point that out. There may be more of you that have discovered that, or maybe you're having a monitor issue and you've been doing something else and been frustrated. Yep, try completely cutting the power from the monitor, yanking the power, and turning it back on. Again, just using the power button doesn't always seem to work, but apparently doing a full disconnect, sort of a hard reboot of the monitor, can help in some cases. The other thing that I pointed out, because the person who wrote in had said one of the ways they were working around it was to use a VNC session to actually get in and reboot the Mac. Since they couldn't see anything on the monitor, the Mac was still running, everything was still working, it was just the monitor that was giving them an issue. They were using VNC. And I mentioned a couple of handy keyboard shortcuts that you could use if the Mac is responsive to actually power down or restart the Mac. Well, one of you wrote in to say, hey, I tried this and it worked great the first time, but when I got to the lock screen and tried the same keyboard shortcuts, they did not work from the lock screen. And I thought, well, that's a little bit odd. And they also pointed out that, you know, if you have your Mac set up in a way where it automatically logs out or goes to the lock screen when it goes to sleep, which I would advise because that's actually a pretty good security feature. And we'll talk a little bit more about that here in a second. It would stink that if this little trick didn't work on the restart stuff. So I gave this a shot, and what I discovered was that if I simply logged out, so if I had an open session on my Mac and I logged out and I tried the keyboard commands, control option plus power to restart and control option command plus power, or the eject button if you don't have a power button on your key. So just substitute eject for power in those commands and they should work. When I would do that after logging out, so I'd already been logged into my Mac working, I go to log out or I wait for it to time out and log me out of my session, I could use those keyboard shortcuts and they would work. Once my Mac rebooted and I got back to the login screen, when I tried them again, they didn't work. And I was a little confused on this for a while until I realized what's probably going on is that I use File Vault. So in using File Vault, when you get to that login screen, it's actually the File Vault login and not the main OS login. So you really don't have your Mac quite up and running yet. So those commands will not work from the lock screen or from the login screen if you're using File Vault. So I just wanted to point that out in case others were trying to test this and going, hey, Adam, these things aren't really working for me. Luckily, the scenario that we described with the monitor issue is most likely going to be the former one where you've had a session open, you get logged out, your Mac goes to sleep, and now your monitor's not waking up so you can't access it. So the commands should still work for you, but I just wanted to point out that discrepancy because someone had noticed it when they were trying to test it themselves. And that's just a little follow-up on the whole, you know, monitor won't wake up issue. I had another great email this week with a couple of questions, basically asking, you know, how secure is my operating system? How secure is Mac OS and my user account when I've just set my standard login credentials, right? So you do the right thing. You protect your Mac's user account. You set up a great secure username and password and something that can't be easily guessed. It's nice and long. You maybe store that in your favorite password manager so that you don't forget it. You set up your Mac so it locks when it goes to sleep or after a set amount of inactivity. And you go, great, my data is safe from theft, from, you know, snooping by my nosy roommate, whatever it might be. And you'd be a little bit right, actually not very right. And this is exactly the question that Javier asked me when he emailed me this week. He said, look, if your Mac gets stolen, can someone else access the files via target disk mode? My answer to you, Javier, is absolutely. And then he said, but what if it's encrypted with File Vault? Well, if it's encrypted File Vault, the answer is no. And then his last question is, how secure is your Mac when someone else is trying to get in without the admin password? And without File Vault on, your Mac is pretty much not secure at all. They're not even going to really need the admin password. And I'm going to explain why I gave all of these answers to these questions right now. The first one, target disk mode. I think many of you may not realize that Macs for a long time have had a feature called target disk mode. And what it does is it allows you to mount the internal hard drive from one Mac on another Mac using a USB, FireWire, or in some cases, Thunderbolt cable. So basically, you chain the two Macs together, and then on the Mac whose hard drive you want access to, you boot it into what's called target disk mode. And the way you do that is while you're powering it up, you hold down the command plus T keys, and that becomes the target, or basically you're turning that target Mac into just a disk drive for the other Mac. And once it comes on and it's mounted, all of the files that are on that volume are totally accessible without having to log in or anything. It's just like you attached an external USB hard drive to the other Mac, except in this case, it's a Mac that has all those files and folders. It's the internal hard drive on that Mac. And when File Vault is on, that target Mac actually cannot be accessed without entering the File Vault credentials first, because the drive on that is encrypted with a username and password, and you have to get past and unlock that encryption before it's accessible. So you can protect yourself from that target disk mode exploit by simply using File Vault. The other question that he had was about, you know, the admin account. How secure is that admin account? And if I have that all set up, am I protected? Well, actually, it's pretty easy with a Mac that's not using, again, not using File Vault, it's pretty easy to reset the username or admin password. And this is another thing that a lot of people don't know. User accounts, including the admin account, can be reset when you boot from the recovery partition that's on every Mac. When you install Mac OS X, it now creates a recovery partition. In the past, it was also doable. You just had to use the, you know, the boot DVD or CD that came with your Mac. But basically, you boot into recovery mode by holding down Command and R when booting up your Mac. And then once you're in recovery mode, you go to the Utilities menu and open up the terminal. And then in the terminal at the command prompt, you just simply type reset password, and it will bring up a little user interface that will allow you to select any user account on the Mac and reset its password. You click save, restart, and then you can log in using the new updated credentials, and you're done. So if a thief knows this, they can simply take that stolen Mac, go through this procedure, and boom, they're into your account, whether it's the admin account or any other user account that's on your Mac. But again, this technique will not work on a Mac that has File Vault enabled. That's because the user accounts won't be accessible when you boot into the recovery mode and try the reset password trick. It just simply won't be able to see the user accounts, again, because the drive is encrypted. The drive needs to be decrypted first, and in order to do that, what you'd have to do while in recovery mode is open up the disk utility application and then mount by authenticating with your File Vault username and password, authenticate that drive. Once the drive is then mounted and decrypted, you can go in and use the password reset trick, but you can't do it until then. And chances are, if you've done everything right, a criminal or a thief or someone who's just trying to snoop on you is not going to know your File Vault username and password. So they won't be able to reset your account and it'll be protected. So you may be getting to the conclusion that I'm about to give you. That is that the bottom line is, if you're not using File Vault and you only rely on your user account credentials for protecting your data from unauthorized access, the only thing that's really protecting you is what we call security by obscurity. It's just the fact that someone might not know, you know, someone who's trying to get at your data might not know that they can reset your username and password, or that they can boot your Mac into target disk mode. But someone who would know these things would be able to basically bypass your user account username and password fairly easily. So at this point, you might be asking, why does File Vault make a difference? What extra stuff does it do to help keep me protected? Well, first and foremost, File Vault will take your hard drive and encrypt all of the data on that hard drive with separate credentials. The thing about it, though, is that Apple doesn't make it obvious that you're actually using a separate set of credentials, because they set it up in a way where you're really using your Mac OS X login, your standard username and password. So when you turn on File Vault, behind the scenes, what actually happens is it uses your Mac OS credentials to set up File Vault credentials and encrypt your hard drive. The thing about it is that the File Vault credentials are actually stored separately and in a separate part of the operating system. When you enable File Vault, the system mirrors your account password to the File Vault volume's EFI login prompt. And then when you restart or reboot your Mac after you've enabled File Vault, what happens is you get to a login screen, and it looks visually exactly the same as your main Mac OS login screen, but it's actually the File Vault login. And at this point, your Mac's hard drive is actually still encrypted. It's not accessible by the system until you pass File Vault authentication. So you enter your username and password just like you did before you enabled File Vault. And what happens is if you pass that login, your system's volume is decrypted and mounted, and then your login credentials are passed by the system behind the scenes to the system login, and you're automatically authenticated into your Mac OS X user account. And that's because, again, the username and passwords are mirrored, and you're logged into your Mac. So you really only go through the process of seeing one login, but you're actually kind of logging in twice, per se. You're logging in once to unlock and decrypt your hard drive, and then logging into the operating system. And if you change your account's password in the user group system preferences in Mac OS X, what happens is the system automatically updates the File Vault EFI login and password so that they always match. They're always just kept matching and up to date. But where things become different with File Vault enabled is when you try and use any of these other methods for changing your password. So going into this recovery mode, resetting the password, if you're doing that outside the user and group's system preferences on the Mac, you're not going to be able to get in without first getting past the File Vault decryption. So in this scenario, things like the password command in the terminal or that reset password tool in the recovery volume, they will not properly update the EFI login and password. Even if you could get into them, they're not going to update the File Vault information. So simply put, with File Vault on, there's really no way to bypass or reset the user account passwords without first getting past the File Vault login. And so that's really what ultimately keeps you protected. So if you're concerned at all about this stuff after hearing this explanation, I would really advise turning on File Vault. And it really is as simple as flipping a switch, going into System Preferences, going into Security and Privacy, authenticating with your account by clicking the little lock, your admin account, and then turning on File Vault. And then everything else happens behind the scenes. It will ask you a few questions. It'll ask you to set up some recovery options, but then you're done. And then you just let it do its thing in the background. And I've been using File Vault for a couple years now, and I can say that I have had zero issues with it. I'm not going to say that it's issue-free. There have been people that have been impacted or affected by File Vault. General rules apply that we always apply. Make sure that you have full backups before you enable File Vault and that those backups are accessible, but it really shouldn't cause you any problems. Back in the day, the original version of File Vault before we had File Vault 2 did have a number of issues, and a lot of people were afraid to use it, and I generally didn't advise people to use it. But I think File Vault 2 is pretty robust and pretty safe and worth turning on. But just in case you're worried, what happens if you forget your File Vault login? Well, you really don't want to find yourself in that scenario. So when you do set that up, I really advise using a password manager like 1Password or LastPass or whatever one you prefer, or some other method. Write it down and put it in your safe deposit box. Whatever it is, you don't want to forget your File Vault password. But even if you do, Apple has provided a few backup plans. You can actually reset the password using something called the Reset Password Assistant, and you can also reset using a recovery key. So when you turn File Vault on, it gives you a couple options. You can create a File Vault recovery key, and if you have that, you can actually use that to get in and reset your password. Again, once you have the recovery key, I would advise taking that, putting it in a secure note in your password manager or something like that. Write it down so that you have it handy. They've also set up a thing where you can choose an option to have your iCloud credentials, your iCloud account, be able to be used to reset your File Vault password. And just be aware, if you choose to do that, Apple is storing your File Vault encryption keys up in iCloud. Some people worry about that just from a privacy standpoint. Apple would have access to those encryption keys. And the idea there is that if you got yourself in that scenario, Apple could potentially help you out, help you get at your encrypted volume. So again, it's a choice you have to make. Some people choose to do it, some people don't. I actually chose to do that. If you do, make sure, again, that your iCloud username and password are really good and really secure as well, because if someone could get into your account, they could potentially get at those file vault encryption keys. So just be aware of all of that stuff. And one last thing to note, File Vault only encrypts the macOS boot volume by default when you enable it. So if you're doing other kinds of backups, Time Machine, Super Duper, Carbon Copy Cloner, those volumes are not encrypted just because you've turned on File Vault 2. And I point that out because if your hard drive, your backup hard drives were to get stolen, even if your internal hard drive was encrypted and you didn't enable encryption on those backup volumes, then your data, once again, is not going to be protected and it is going to be accessible. For Time Machine, it's relatively easy to encrypt those now. When you turn on and select the volume in the Time Machine preferences, there's a little checkbox that says Encrypt Backup. If you check that, then File Vault will be applied to your Time Machine backups. For third-party backup solutions, I would advise that you check with the software maker. So if you're using Super Duper or Carbon Copy Cloner, go to their support website, search for File Vault encryption, and follow their instructions, because there is some separate and special things you need to do to make it work, and it varies depending upon the backup solution that you're using. But you certainly can enable File Vault with those. If you just have standard volumes, external drives that you want to put File Vault encryption on, Apple makes it relatively easy. You can simply right-click or control-click on the volume in the Finder and choose the encrypt command. Just be aware that File Vault 2 encryption on external drives only works if that drive is formatted as a Mac OS extended journaled volume. So if you're using some other formatting scheme, you're not going to see that option to encrypt the drive. And that is how you do encryption on the Mac. And again, I would seriously consider it if you're concerned about protecting the privacy and security of your data. I've been doing the MacCast now for over 12 years, and there's probably one subject. I mean, we cover a lot of subjects on this show, and it seems like I've covered just about everything. But there's one subject that I know we've mentioned from time to time, but I don't think I've ever really covered it or we've ever really had a discussion on it very much, and that is CarPlay. Well, this week I want to change that a little bit because I received this feedback and these comments from Steve.
Hi, Adam. This is Steve from Northern Ireland. I've been listening to your show since I got my first Mac back in 2006. We've corresponded a few times since then. However, this is the first time I have sent an audio comment because I have an issue I feel very strongly about. That is Apple CarPlay and how it's at best a massive disappointment and at worst it's not fit for purpose and in some instances downright dangerous. Now, Adam, I know you've said in the past you're not a car guy. Well, I am. When I got my new SUV last year, I was looking forward to car integration as much as I was with the car's other fancy systems and driver aids. Okay, so what are the problem areas? Well, there are two. It's inconsistent UI that relies far too heavily on Siri and its mysterious lack of third-party apps compared to its main rival platform. It looks like Apple's design philosophy has been to reduce distracted driving by using the audio interface as much as possible. Well, that's fine if Siri worked anyway well. Good example, just the other day, with a strong 4G data signal, I said, show maps, and I got a reply from Siri, sorry, I can't park your car. Unbelievable. This reliance on Siri is frustrating in the SMS app, where it uses audio rather than displaying message on the screen, and at times does a pretty poor job of transcribing them. This is even worse when I try to send a message. I can't remember the last time I got it right first time and I didn't have to say cancel, try again. Now, whilst I wasn't born in the metropolitan elite areas of the United States, I don't think I need elocution lessons just quite yet. The next major issue in CarPlay is Apple Maps. Now, I wish they had taken the philosophy of minimising looking at the screen and the interaction with it. The Maps interface can't be pinched or zoomed or scrolled with the touch interface. You need to repeatedly tap arrow keys and zoom buttons. This is primitive compared with Android Auto or even every other OEM sat-nav system in most vehicles. Speaking of Android Auto, one feature that you would expect it as a must when you're driving is the weather, and it's not there. In fact, I get severe weather warnings from the UK Met Office pushed to my phone, and they don't appear on the Apple CarPlay interface. The last issue I have is no CarPlay support for certain third-party apps. We briefly discussed this, Adam, and you said it was simply up to the developer to support CarPlay, and Apple had no reason to push back against this. Sorry, Adam, I don't buy this. If you look at the supported apps on the two major platforms, you find notable omissions on CarPlay, mainly services that compete with Apple's own. The major ones that keep being mentioned are WhatsApp and Telegram. Another app that a lot of people are crying out for is an alternative mapping solution, such as Waze. Before anybody says it's owned by Google and isn't on Android Auto either, well, just this week I saw its functionality is being incorporated into the Spotify Android Auto app. Also, what I can see of the third-party music apps and CarPlay are pretty crippled. You can access playlists and that's about it. And many other streaming services like Google Play Music and my own Amazon Unlimited are not there at all, despite having an iOS app. Contrary to what you said, Adam, something fishy is going on here, and I firmly believe Apple is blocking them. All of the above are shortcomings, but the final thing I want to mention is something I think is dangerous. When you connect your smartphone to CarPlay interface, its logo fills the iPhone screen. However, you can simply press the home button and interact with the phone normally. To me, this defeats the purpose of having smartphone functionality in their vehicle and at the same time minimise distracted driving. I'm not an expert on Android Auto, but I believe the connection to the Android Auto, the phone goes into a reduced interface mode to stop people making lower level menu adjustments when driving. What Apple needs to do with CarPlay is to sort out how you interact with it and open up this platform, and even to those who compete with their services. And if they're not prepared to do this, go to the other extreme and lock it down to stop people fiddling with their iPhone when driving and take the resultant flak for it. Many of those points I see raised elsewhere, not from Apple fanboys, Android fanboys, the general tech community, but from car people on car forums. In fact, I've now stopped using CarPlay and rely on Volkswagen's own OEM system that's an order of magnitude more usable for calls, music and maps via the iPhone Bluetooth interface. At the end of 2017, I'll be thinking about a new phone and I want a device with a larger screen to watch sports. And I'll have a decision to make. And alas, car functionality is very much pushing me to the Android platform. Anyway, Adam, thanks for your great show and keep up the good work.
Hey, thanks, Steve. I appreciate the comments and the feedback. I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to speak too much to this, but I'm hoping that the community will chime in on it a little bit. That's because I really can't afford new cars or at least expensive new head units, so I don't have access to CarPlay at all. So I really can't kind of push back on really anything that you said. I drive a paid for 2001 Subaru with about 200,000 miles on it, and I'll probably be driving that for the next 5 years or so, So I'm going to really open this one up to the community. I'd love to know what others of you think about CarPlay and the integration and the apps that are available. To kind of address some of the things that you mentioned in your voicemail there, Steve, one thing I wonder about with the command open maps or show maps is if you tried open maps and got it to work. I get that you shouldn't have to do that, but I was just kind of curious about it. If it's more of a command sort of thing than the fact that Siri wasn't understanding what you were asking. Another tip I can give you when using the messaging app, if it gets something wrong in terms of the dictation, you can use the command change it instead of cancel, and it will go in back into the interface and allow you to re-record or re-dictate the message and hopefully get it right the second time. I do wish Apple would add some of the features where you could go in and change individual parts. I know that's part of dictation, or has been in the past part of dictation on the Mac. It'd be great to see that on iOS. But another thing that you can do is when Siri does end up dictating your message correctly and asks you, would you like me to send it? If she doesn't read it back to you, which is something that I've encountered just using Siri plugged into the auxiliary cable in my car, you can use the command review it, and she will read back the message so you can make sure that it's correct before you send it. And then again, if it's incorrect, you can simply say change it, and it'll give you another opportunity to dictate your message. Again, you shouldn't have to dictate it more than once. I get that that's the point of the whole thing. But if you do, it's a hands-free, distraction-free way to actually get through that scenario. So hopefully that helps you out a little bit too. Finally, according to Apple's CarPlay developer site, it says that CarPlay now supports messaging apps. And if your messaging app is enabled to work with Siri, it can be updated to appear in CarPlay. So at least in the case of messaging apps, if they can get the messaging app working with Siri, it should be able to work with CarPlay. So if you come across a messaging app that doesn't, I would encourage you to contact the developer and say, can you please add CarPlay support? As far as the other kinds of apps, you may have a point. You know, Apple could be blocking things, and maybe you've presented some good evidence for that. The one thing that I can tell you, or actually more accurately, tell developers who'd like to see their apps available in CarPlay, is that Apple's developer site does say that if you have an audio, a automaker, or a messaging app that you think should work with CarPlay and doesn't, that you can contact developer.apple.com/contact/CarPlay. Does require a developer account to go there, but you can go to that page and actually submit a message to Apple saying you think your app or this app should work with CarPlay. And I guess that would probably kick off the procedure of trying to get Apple to approve the CarPlay app. As far as us end users go, I would also say that you could use the iPhone section of apple.com/feedback and register a complaint with Apple. Say, I think that Waze should be allowed and should be an app that's available through CarPlay. I would also contact Waze and say, why don't you have CarPlay? I don't know if they would publicly speak to it, if Apple is blocking them, or if they just haven't tried. I really have no idea. I haven't done any research into it. But, you know, CarPlay, I think, development has been one of those things that's been a little bit slow, and Apple probably does need to step things up. You know, I think you're correct, especially on the third-party access for maps. I think maybe Apple hasn't really opened that up yet, and maybe they never will. And that's a little bit disappointing because we do have alternative apps on the iPhone. I kind of see CarPlay as just an extension of the iPhone. And I think ultimately any app that makes sense to work on the in-screen navigation on a car should be able to do that. It should be up to the developer to decide if they want a CarPlay version of their app, just like they might decide if they want an Apple TV version of their app or not. So I get your point, and thank you for starting up the conversation. Hopefully some others of the community will jump in here, and we'll play some feedback and some comments from them on future episodes. But until then, again, Steve, thanks for your voicemail. Last thing that I want to talk about today is a little application that I think can help you with your live photos. I haven't gotten very deep into live photos. I occasionally take them on my phone. I have a couple of them in there. I've put some on my lock screen and played around with those features. But I think one of the things that holds people back is the fact that you really can't edit or change your live photos very much, at least not very easily with Apple's built-in applications. But this week, Google put out an update to an application that I didn't even know that they had that is specifically designed to help you do a few extra things with your live photos, and it's called Motion Stills. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, but it was originally designed to remove motion shake from your live photos and to give you some export and sharing functionality to go to some other services, including the ability to create an animated GIF or GIF from your live photos. And a recent update has brought a few bits of extra functionality that I think some people might find useful. So it'll let you combine multiple live photos together into a movie. It will let you loop your live photos back and forth so you can have them going in a nice continuous loop. And it'll even let you add text that is live, meaning that it will track, and you can get it to track along with a person or an object that's in your live photo. And like I said, you can share those creations either back to live photo, put them back in your camera roll as new live photos, or you can send them out as animated GIFs, which you can use on other websites. The latest version also added a feature that I think a lot of us, myself included, would like Apple to add, and that's the ability to set a keyframe for your live photo. So if you've ever used live photos, you know what happens is you take a what looks like a regular photo with the live photo feature enabled, and what it actually captures is, I think, 1.5 seconds before that photo was taken and 1.5 seconds after that photo was taken. And inevitably, if you watch the live photo back, there might be a frame in that that's actually better than the still frame that you captured. So maybe someone smiled just right before, you know, better right before or right after the photo that you took. And you'd rather see, when you're in photos, the still frame that has the better image in it. Well, you can change it now using the Motion Stills app from Google. So how do you do it? You get the Motion Stills app for free from the App Store. You open the app. It will ask for access to your photos. You give it access, and then it finds all of the live photos that are in your photo library. And then you can select the live photo that you want to change the keyframe for. And then when it comes up in the main Motion Stills interface, make sure in the editor you turn off the Motion Stills feature and you turn off the loop back and forth feature if you don't want to apply those. So if you're just looking to change the keyframe, you're going to want to turn those off. And then you tap the share button in the application and choose to export as a live photo, which is going to save the live photo back to your camera roll. And when you choose that option, you'll see you get a little slider that'll allow you to go scrub back and forth, and you can select the keyframe that you want and tap the check mark, and that's going to use that keyframe. So when it saves the live photo back into your camera roll, it will have that keyframe instead of the original keyframe that was taken at the time, or that was set at the time you took the live photo. So that's how you change it. I thought that was cool, a handy little tool, and wanted to share that with you this week. But that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. And be sure to check out Text Expander for Teams. You can see all of their great software, get more information and details by going to smilesoftware.com/maccast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media, and they are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, or if you'd like to chime in on the conversation about CarPlay, you can send me emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. I'm also on Skype, so if you're worried about long-distance charges, you don't want to call in on that voicemail. I actually have voicemail on Skype. You can reach me at my Skype address, which is the MacCast, and you can leave a voicemail there as well. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the MacCast website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And as a matter of fact, we just upgraded the forum software. So there's a great community of people hanging out there that are ready and willing to answer questions, give you tips and tricks. It's a great place to just share ideas with other members of the MacCast community. And we now have things like a leaderboard, and there's an easy way to find the most recent conversations that are going on, the most popular. So the update I'm actually really impressed with. So if you haven't been on the forum in a while, or you've just never been on the MacCast forum, be sure to check it out, forum.maccast.com. And then finally, if you want to follow me online between shows on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Google Plus community at google.com/PlusMacCast. But that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.